Everybody's here? Perfect. This is our fourth time to do oral arguments virtually through the BlueJeans system. It's mostly worked in the prior occasions, but we have our backup plan. Hopefully we won't need it today. This is Michael Gibbons speaking from Carson City. And we have Judge Jerry Tao in Las Vegas, Judge Bonnie Bulla in Las Vegas. I'm the only one at the bench here, so I just took my mask off, but we're still following a protocol of mask in the courthouse and virtually every other setting. And Judge Bulla and Judge Tao are close to each other, so they're keeping their masks on. Fortunately, counsel don't have to wear a mask. That's a big, big advantage. Judge Tao, do you have any welcoming comments?
No, just to thank the attorneys. We know that we're in this unusual time, and we appreciate your accommodating us and conducting the argument this way. It's not what anybody would prefer, but it's the best we can do under the circumstances, and we're looking forward to the argument.
Judge Bulla?
Just thank you all for participating today. Please let us know if you cannot understand one of us, and we'll certainly be happy to repeat a question, and thank you for both for all the good work you did on the case. Thank you.
Yeah, you're both loud and clear through the masks already, so I can hear you well.
All right, we have three cases on for today. The first one is case number 78954-COA, Larry Porchia versus City of Las Vegas. We have for the appellant, Mr. Porchia, Stephanie Zena. All right, just like it's spelled. And for City of Las Vegas, Jeffrey Dorachak. Am I close?
Cak. Yeah, close. Cak. C-A-K.
All right, yeah. Dorachak. All right. Welcome to both of you. We're looking forward to hearing from you today. This is a very interesting case, and we would be happy to have oral argument on a case like this, no matter what the circumstances are. So thank you, Ms. Zena, for taking this case on. Would you like to reserve any time for a rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, 3 minutes. All right. We have some technology staff with us, too, in both locations, and we have the clock on the screen, which I'm sure you can see. So when it hits 3 minutes, you're going to hear it and you're going to see it. All right, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Stephanie Zena. I am pro bono counsel for my client, Larry Porchia. Mr. Porchia, at the time of this incident, was an indigent homeless individual. In the early mornings of August 26, 2015, he began to experience excruciating stomach pains, vomiting, nausea, loss of consciousness, and hot flashes. A friend of Mr. Porsche's called 911, and Las Vegas Fire and Rescue was dispatched to the scene. The EMTs with Las Vegas Fire and Rescue evaluated Mr. Porchia, and upon learning he was homeless and uninsured, they declared him to be suffering from gas pains and canceled ambulance transport. 8 hours later, another friend of Mr. Porsche's called emergency services again, and this time Mr. Porchia was transported to Valley Hospital, where he underwent emergency bowel surgery. Mr. Porchia filed a lawsuit against the City of Las Vegas and the two individual EMTs with Las Vegas Fire and Rescue that appeared to his aid the very first time, and he alleged negligence for their failure to transport him. The City of Las Vegas claimed immunity pursuant to NRS 41500, the Good Samaritan Statute, and NRS 410336, or the Public Duty Doctrine. The court, after permitting Mr. Porchia a few times to amend, ultimately granted dismissal, finding that the Public Duty Doctrine shielded the defendants from liability. The issues on appeal are whether Mr. Porchia's claims fall within an exception in each of these statutes. I'd like to start with NRS 410336 to begin with. That statute holds that a fire department is not liable for negligent acts or omissions unless the actors have made a specific promise or the conduct affirmatively caused the harm. The city has argued there was no special relationship between Mr. Porcia and Las Vegas Fire and Rescue, and no specific promises were made. And they summarily concluded that there was no affirmative harm because they did not cause the need for Mr. Porcia's ultimate bowel obstruction surgery. However, Mr. Porcia's pleadings at the lower level were very clear, taking them as a whole. Mr. Porcia specifically claimed, both in pleadings and in front of the court at oral argument, that his nurses and his physician told him that but for the delay in treatment, he may not have required surgery. He further alleges pain and suffering due to the delay, as well as unnecessary blood loss. The Supreme Court has enunciated a standard for affirmative harm in the Cody v. Washoe County case, wherein the state actor must actively create a situation which leads directly to the damaging result. In Cody, a drunk driver was pulled over by a police officer. The officer did not arrest him, but called his mother and left him on the side of the road. That driver carried on, got into an accident, and unfortunately killed himself and another driver. The court ultimately held that there was no affirmative conduct on behalf of the officer. However, this dissent in that case is very telling. The dissent noted that a jury could conclude that the officer affirmatively caused the harm by failing to arrest the driver, thereby removing him from posing a threat to others on the road. The dissent noted that holding officers liable for affirmative harm does not subject the government to excess liability, which is a concern noted by the city. Legislature set forth exceptions for a reason. The legislature acknowledged that there are circumstances that do not warrant immunity. Here, the city of Las Vegas defendants did not cause Mr. Porcia's bowel obstruction. They did not cause his abdominal pain or his hot flashes. However, they did affirmatively cause a delay in treatment when they refused to transport him on the basis that he was indigent and had no health insurance. That delay in treatment, per Mr. Porcia's pleadings, was the primary cause for emergency surgery, as opposed to more conservative treatments that may have rendered surgery unnecessary. The city argues that the EMTs took Mr. Porcia's vitals, that he asked him questions about his condition and otherwise rendered care at the scene and ultimately determined that transport was not necessary. They could not have foreseen a bowel obstruction, is their argument. This evaluation in the field was enough, and any omission in failing to take Mr. Porcia to the hospital was not affirmative harm. This is an interesting point because the city argues that a comprehensive evaluation was performed in the field. However, their own record is blank as to any evaluation performed of Mr. Porcia, and that record is located in the Record on Appeal, Volume 1, at pages 25 to 26. That document lists the responding EMTs, the date and time, but no patient information, no assessment, no history, no vitals, and that note also states that Mr. Porcia specifically declined transport. The city's own briefing states that they acknowledge Mr. Porcia requested transport to the hospital, and the EMTs determined it was not necessary.
Well, I mean, this is an appeal off of a 12B5 dismissal in which we only have the pleadings. So you can't really argue, you know, stuff that's outside the pleadings. So what in your pleadings, what factual allegations in your pleading, which taken under the standard of 12B5 in the light most favorable to you, et cetera, support this?
Sure, Your Honor. This is not a case where we have ordinary negligence. This is a case where the EMTs caused affirmative harm. They affirmatively decided to cease treatment. They affirmatively decided to leave Mr. Porcia. They affirmatively decided to decline him transport on the basis that he was homeless and indigent. Mr. Porcia alleged in his pleadings that once the EMTs arrived, they began to assess him, and upon learning that he was homeless and had no health insurance, they immediately ceased treatment and evaluation, took him off the stretcher, told him he had gas pains, affirmatively canceled the AMR ambulance that had shown up to transport him, and left the scene. Mr. Porcia then suffered. Yes.
I am so sorry to interrupt. I just want to make sure that on the public duty doctrine, you're really concentrating on the second exception, because I did not certainly in your briefing, does not appear that the special duty is being argued. It's just the affirmative harm. And am I correct on that?
So, Your Honor, I believe that the affirmative harm is the better applicable exception. However, there could be a special duty given that these were trained EMTs subject to the rules and regulations of the Administrative Code, Chapter 450B. And I believe Mr. Porcia argued that at the lower court as well. However, his pleadings indicate that there was affirmative harm done to him by the actions of the EMTs in declining to render aid and transport to him on the basis that he was homeless and indigent. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. Is it just affirmative harm, or is it continuous and ongoing affirmative harm? Something more than just affirmative harm.
I do not know of a case that requires continuous and ongoing harm. For instance, if you take a look at the Ninth Circuit case, Pania versus City of Huntington Park, it's a situation very similar to this, wherein the officers responded to a distress call, found a man in medical need, and canceled the ambulance and left him alone, locked in his apartment. The court there found that the officers had affirmatively caused him harm by taking steps that increased his risk. So I am unaware of any decision that requires the state actors to affirmatively cause the harm with ongoing conduct. The Munger case, another Ninth Circuit case, Munger versus City of Glasgow Police Department, is another case where, the police officers ejected a man from an intoxicated man from a bar into freezing temperatures and then left him. That man later died of hypothermia. So the police officers left that man. In the Munger case, he later died. They weren't continually ongoing causing the harm. And the same with the Pania case. The officers were not continually causing ongoing harm to the man, but by increasing these people's risk, those officers were held to engage in affirmative conduct for the purposes of the public duty doctrine.
Well, usually, traditionally, affirmative harm means things like, you know, you call a police officer shows up and, like, shoots you, right? He actually caused the harm. Now, I know that this isn't a police officer case, but in this case, couldn't the argument be made that this guy's medical condition wasn't caused by the EMTs? He would have suffered from it whether or not the EMTs showed up at all. So how are they placing him, how are they affirmatively causing that harm?
Yes, Your Honor. So you were correct that the City of Las Vegas did not cause Mr. Porcia's underlying medical condition. They did not cause his bowel obstruction or his pain. However, the delay in treatment was the harm. So the Cody case does not require that the harm be an active harm, meaning that there is an intentional tort or something of that sort perpetrated upon a person. The standard for affirmative harm, as enunciated in Cody versus Washoe County, is that the state actor must actively create a situation which leads directly to the damaging result. So here we have state actors, the EMTs, creating a situation that led to a damaging result. They created the situation where they ceased treatment, ceased evaluation, and affirmatively ceased transport to the hospital. And that led, per Mr. Porcia's doctors and nurses, to the damaging result of requiring emergency surgery as opposed to more conservative measures to treat a bowel obstruction. The other statute that is that can provide immunity is the Good Samaritan statute, NRS 41.500. And that statute holds that rescuers are not liable for civil damages unless their actions are grossly negligent. Gross negligence is usually a question of fact. The city argues that Mr. Porcia did not adequately plead gross negligence at the lower court level. However, his pleadings are replete. The conduct alleged, as well as multiple references throughout his complaints and oppositions to motions to dismiss, to gross negligence standards. He was a pro per plaintiff at that time. His pleadings can be a little inartful. However, the facts are there to support a claim for gross negligence that the EMTs arrived, assessed him, and left him on the sole basis that he was indigent and without insurance.
Ms. Zena, do you believe that the Good Samaritan Doctrine, which is incorporated within 41.500, applies in a situation where the EMTs were under a duty to respond to the call?
I do not believe that the Good Samaritan statute would apply to provide immunity here, not only on the basis that the statutes would provide a duty to respond to a call, but also because I do not believe that the city should be able to claim double immunity on the basis of the public duty doctrine and the Good Samaritan statute.
So which one do you believe applies in this case? If we could pick one, which one applies?
If we could pick one, I would believe that the Good Samaritan statute is probably more applicable because the public duty doctrine discusses firefighters and police officers responding within that scope of their duty. These gentlemen were not responding as firefighters. They were responding as EMTs. They were medical rescuers.
Right,
and I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal unless there's questions.
All right, Ms. Zenit, you'll have just under 2.5 minutes. We'll return to the respondents now. And Mr. Dorakak.
Thank you again, Your Honors. And may it please the court, Jeff Dorakak for Respondent City of Las Vegas, and our two firefighters, Stephen Massa and Nicholas Pavelka. We believe the issue before the court this morning is clear. Did the appellant in his third amended complaint allege any legal duty owed particularly to him by respondents that can give rise to a claim for negligence? We believe he failed to allege any actionable legal duty. The district court agreed with respondents on our motion to dismiss, and in doing so, they accepted all of Mr. Porcher's allegations as true, and they presumed all fair inferences in his favor in order to look for any discernible duty of care in his third amended complaint. As a result, we request that the court this morning uphold the conclusion of the lower court, which was essentially that respondents' emergency response, the entire emergency response, including any transport or lack thereof, is a duty owed to the public at large rather than a duty of care owed particularly to the appellant. Furthermore, respondents did not owe the appellant a special duty to transport. They did not affirmatively and directly cause the bowel obstruction surgery, and they did not breach any other distinguishable duty of care that can be found throughout the third amended complaint authored by the appellant. As already discussed in the opening argument by the appellant, this is a public duty doctrine case, and we believe the public duty doctrine applies to this case because respondents' emergency medical response, including everything involved with that, a transport, lack thereof, the arrival at the scene, their work at the scene, is a duty owed to the public at large, not individually to Mr. Porcher. And the Nevada Supreme Court has upheld and accepted the public duty doctrine. The Nevada legislature promulgated in NRS 41.0336 the codification of the public duty doctrine, but it did not abrogate the broader common law public duty doctrine. As a result, we have both the statute and the broader concept of the public duty doctrine to point to in this matter. Regarding NRS 41.0336 and the doctrine, the case law, the history of the statute, and the legislative history behind Chapter 41, Section 336 all make plain that this case is a matter that's covered by the public duty doctrine. The goal of the doctrine is to curb lawsuits like this one that look to hold fire departments, their paramedics, their EMTs liable for simply exercising their public duties. When NRS 41.0336 was codified, the Nevada legislature explicitly wrote in the legislative history that we provided in our brief that they intended that statute to cover firefighters rendering emergency medical services. EMTs, paramedics existed when this statute was being written. They knew they needed to cover them as well, and we believe it applies here.
Let me ask you this question. So I think the argument that, you know, granted that the pleadings below, because the guy didn't have an attorney, aren't that well-crafted. But I think the argument she's making is a little bit more subtle. There's a long line of cases that goes back 100 years that if you call 911, the government doesn't actually have a duty to respond on a timely basis. That's a generalized duty to everybody. But in a case like this, let's say an EMT comes, they actually take the guy to a public hospital, let's call it UMC's emergency room, which is a publicly funded hospital or subsidized hospital. It's open to all by law. And then someone there commits malpractice. At some point in the chain, the government has assumed some responsibility. Like, you're in the EMT emergency room and the doctor there commits malpractice. I think we'd all agree in that situation, you can sue the publicly funded hospital. So there's, so the, I think the argument she's trying to make is there's a spectrum here. There's no duty to show up, but at some point deep down the chain when you're actually at UMC, all the rules of medical malpractice apply. So the question is, where in that spectrum does this statute cut things off? And I think her argument is maybe they didn't have a duty to show up. Maybe they didn't have a duty to even render aid. They could have just gone to Dunkin' Donuts instead of responding to the call, and that would not have been a lawsuit. But once they show up and make affirmative representations to the guy that you don't need a hospital, I think she's arguing that's where the statute, that's where you get past this statute on this spectrum.
Right, Your Honor. The city totally agrees with what you described there as a spectrum. The issue here is that on that spectrum, the appellant failed in any way to allege a duty on the spectrum. So we have the public duty, essentially, as you noted, the firefighters could not have, they could have stayed in the station and not responded. Public duty doctrine applies. The public duty doctrine applies even to the response, showing up at the scene, all of the general governmental response you would expect from firefighters or paramedics. Now, when does some action take over for the public duty doctrine? Well, we've already hit on what that would be. It would be one of the two exceptions, either a specific duty, or a special duty or a specific promise. That's the first exception. The second exception is some affirmative conduct. That goes to your hypothetical of, well, they get to the hospital, something happens in the hospital. Now we've got affirmative conduct, and yes, under at that point in the spectrum, you're likely out of the public duty doctrine because something affirmative happened, and now the question becomes, is it the active, continuous cause of the harm? Now, in this case, they can't hit either exception, and the only little root that could be possibly grabbed from the complaint, the lower court examined as well, and that's why we included the backup liability protection here, which was the gross negligence protection under 41-500. Because they failed to articulate any affirmative conduct in terms of what they are calling the delay, that's not affirmative conduct. That's simply they reviewed him, they didn't, nothing needed to be done, and they sent home the extra ambulance to do other work. They're still in the public duty doctrine. The only possible allegation that would be available to the appellant would be, was there some type of bad medical work done when he was placed on the stretcher? The reality, though, is his pleadings explicitly state that they placed him on the stretcher, they took his vitals, they asked about his symptoms, they were figuring out what, they took his temperature, and basically, as you brought up earlier, Your Honor, he, in his own complaint, said, I was seeking to be transported. I informed, after they took all of that information, he then informed them that he didn't have insurance. His own next sentence, the paramedics refused to transport me by stating, I only had stomach gas. Their conclusion for not transporting was based on the medical diagnosis of the facts purported by the appellant. That ends any discussion. We're a little bit now into my second argument, but to the extent that there's any duty to be claimed of medical malpractice on the stretcher, there's nothing purporting to be gross negligence in the complaint. And that's the only route to get him into discovery. And because he failed to plead gross negligence, and in fact he explicitly removed gross negligence between his second and third amended complaint, he superseded any ability to say, well, I'm pleading gross negligence. So to your question, that is where on the spectrum he could find a duty of care. The judge in the lower court asked him, they had a discussion about this, and the judge properly concluded, well, there's no claims here for gross negligence. There's no facts that would even, with a fair inference, allow me to continue on that route. So as I noted, the two narrow exceptions, specific promise or special duty, and affirmative action, neither exists in this case. Throughout the lower court pleadings, the transport argument fundamentally goes to, well, they owed me some duty to transport because they showed up. Well, there's no such special duty in any rule statute. There was no promise made by either Mr. Massa or Mr. Pavelka to the appellant. So their only option was then to go to the second narrow exception for public duty doctrine, which would be some type of affirmative conduct. However, respondents didn't affirmatively or directly cause the bowel obstruction surgery, as appellants concede this morning. The new theory also doesn't even meet the legal requirements of this second narrow exception of what affirmative conduct would look like. What they are actually alleging is an omission, basically the failure to allow AMR to come and do a second immediate opinion after the city's fire paramedics already determined, well, we reviewed him, there's no need to transport here. They're alleging an act of omission. As they conceded and as I noted, this is not a direct and active cause of the harm. And finally, the alleged conduct didn't breach any duty. He was not owed a second immediate redundant medical review just because AMR happened to be at the scene. The city performed its public duty and they moved on, and AMR went away because the check was done.
So let me ask you this. In a 12B5 appeal, we have to take the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff and also all reasonable inferences. So you're arguing that this is, as phrased in the complaint, an omission, but an omission and affirmative act are two sides of the same coin. Couldn't you argue that what he's saying is, not only did they fail to take me to the hospital, but by affirmatively telling me that there was nothing serious going on, they actively dissuaded me from seeking medical help on my own. Maybe I would have gone to the quick care down the street, but they told me that it wasn't worth going to the quick care for. Couldn't we, to the extent that we have this liberal pleading standard 12B5, isn't that a reasonable inference or a reasonable interpretation of the allegation here?
I think, Your Honor, it would be quite a stretch to infer that, even if we were to infer that into his pleadings. Again, this is, for a pro per pleader, this was his fourth complaint. He knew what he was doing in terms of getting the facts straightened out, putting things in that he wanted in there. This wasn't someone who was just throwing it down the first time. This was his fourth rewrite of the document. Now, not only is that particular, as you said, the other side of the coin, not in the complaint, but if we were to infer that, the issue then becomes, what exactly are we looking for in affirmative conduct? We want active, we want direct, we want continuous, we want it to bring about, it needs to bring about the harm to be affirmative conduct that can then proceed to the discovery phase. The other thing that the federal cases give us is a nice kind of, tying it all together. We need to see his status quo negatively impacted here. And the reality is, the medical review was done on the stretcher. The vitals were taken. Symptoms were asked. He was reviewed. The city firefighters determined no transport was needed. No transport was owed to him. Then he was left in the same location with the same symptoms. He wasn't put or moved into any negative situation. Now, there might be a mindset that you're alluding to, although that's not in any of the complaint. The other thing would be, even if he had that mindset, his status quo remained the same. He remained in the same situation, and as a result, in which he did 8 hours later, could have immediately called somebody else to the scene to transport him. He could have taken himself to the hospital, or he could have had a third party transport him. Overall, that's the issue with even a liberal pleading review like that, or inferring some type of mental, well, now I've been delayed, I better not call for a while. The reality is, it's not pleaded, and he was in the same situation he was before the firefighters arrived at the scene.
But if we take the allegations as true under 12B5, what is really being said is that the delay itself caused the harm. Specifically, Mr. Porcia alleges that earlier transport would have avoided surgery, would have avoided, I guess now I'm hearing, blood loss as well, but would have taken him out of the ultimate surgery that he required. And it would have, earlier transport would have avoided that type of harm. If we take that as true, is that the type of continuous harm, affirmative harm, that would satisfy the statute?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think when you're talking about the delay, if we want to narrow it down to what he's at, what we're going to give him all benefits of the doubt like we need to, that he's arguing the delay is the issue here. I think at that point you're conceding public duty on the front end, which means public duty doctrine covers the response, the decision not to transport, everything that's normally provided to the public. But where does the delay go, to your question? The delay would have to go to a claim that the medical review, the assessment done by the firefighters, did not live up to its duty of care. In other words, because they screwed up, allegedly, on the review and therefore didn't take him, that caused a delay. That's where the delay would come in. But at that point, you're not in the public duty doctrine anymore. You're on a whole different ball game of, well, this is what they did wrong. They did it. They breached their medical assessment review, and now we need to determine whether or not they lived up to what they needed to do. The problem with that goes back to where I led off with a few minutes ago. The medical assessment would have to have been grossly negligent in order to defeat 41-500 immunity, because now we're talking about the assessment, and for what they did there would have to be grossly negligent. He doesn't plead gross negligence in the complaint, accepting all his statements as true. He admits they did the vital check. They reviewed his situation, and they determined, sorry, you have gas, you don't need to be transported. There's no gross negligence with respect to the delay that would cause 41-500 not to be activated. In other words, even if we somehow narrowed it down to, well, was there a breach of the medical assessment duty here? There's no allegation of gross negligence, and that ends the discussion. Public duty doctrine covers all the transport and everything else. The assessment is covered by the gross negligence immunity under 41-500, and he just cannot get around it. He did not plead it in his complaint. He did not list any facts that should be accepted as true that would even allow an inference of it. So we think both with the public duty doctrine covering everything and along with the back end 41-500 immunity, the city should be dismissed for lack of any legally cognizable duty.
Thank you, Mr. Dorakak. All right, Ms. Zena, we'll go back to you for the rebuttal. 2 minutes and 14 seconds.
Thank you. There's a few things I wanted to touch upon. The standard enunciated by Cody is not a continuous duty. It's just a state actor must actively create a situation leading directly to a result. This standard was also evaluated in Munger versus the City of Glasgow, where if an officer takes affirmative steps to increase the risk of danger to a person, that's an affirmative action pursuant to the public duty doctrine. The city raised possible remedies Mr. Portia had at his disposal. The city suggests that an indigent homeless man repeatedly call 911 for assistance when originally denied. He should have taken himself to the hospital or had a friend take him. I don't know, but I doubt that those options were readily available to Mr. Portia at that time. The Munger case discusses that, however. It discusses mitigation factors, and it states that the court would not rest upon options that may or may not have been available to the individual at the time of the harm. And I think that's an important standard to note. We're not looking at, well, perhaps the EMTs negligently assessed him, but he had other remedies. The standard is, did the EMTs, upon arriving, fail to treat him to the level that either rose to gross negligence or caused him affirmative harm? And taking the facts most favorable to the plaintiff, as the standard of dismissal requires at the pleading stage, Mr. Portia absolutely articulated conduct that would rise to the level of both affirmative harm and gross negligence. The city argues that maybe bad medical work was done and we just don't know. Well, that's part of the problem with dismissal at the pleading stage. We don't know. Discovery would have been appropriate into that evaluation to determine why they stopped the evaluation, why they came to the conclusion that they did, and Mr. Porsche's allegation that they only came to that conclusion on the basis that he was indigent and homeless, which in and of itself is an affirmative harm to Mr. Portia and can rise to the level of gross negligence, or a reasonable juror could conclude would be gross negligence. And thank you, Your Honor.
You can conclude your thought. You don't have to stop mid-sentence.
And so the lower court should be reversed. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Zena. On behalf of, you've pronounced his name as Mr. Portia.
Correct.
We heard his name pronounced as Mr. Porsche from Mr. Dorakak and from Judge Bulla and I as Porchia. Do you know what the actual pronunciation is, Ms. Zena, or are you doing your best estimate?
No, it's Portia.
Porsche, like the car?
Correct.
All right. Well, thank you. Very good work on this. And also very good work, Mr. Dorakak. Quite an interesting case. This matter will be taken under submission for a written decision from the court as soon as we can. Judge Tao or Judge Bulla, do you have any concluding comments?
Yeah, I had forgotten, Ms. Zinner, that you took this case to the pro bono program, and I wanted to thank you for doing that. As you all know, there are more cases than our lawyers willing to take them, and we're always thrilled to see someone of your caliber stepping up and volunteering to help on a completely free basis. But, you know, just as an observation, this is absolutely not a criticism of you or anybody else who takes a case to the pro bono program. But, you know, as you can see, one of the problems is we have this program up here at the appellate level. But in cases like this, you know, you're kind of stuck with the record the way it is. And, you know, he probably needed a lawyer down below. His case may have been totally different. But, you know, that's not your fault. There is no such thing as a pro bono program down there. I'm really glad you participated when you did. But, you know, one of the handicaps we see repeatedly to this program is you jump in now, you're stuck with what happened below. And that's just the way it is. But we do appreciate your time and your effort. And to both of you, really good argument, really interesting case. And thanks to both of you.
I would just join my thanks to both of you as well. And you can't see me smiling behind my mask, but I really appreciated all the answers that you gave to the questions. Both of you did an excellent job. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And, Ms. Zinn, I hope you are willing to take another case in the future through the pro bono program.
Was
this a good experience?
I've done this quite a bit. I do enjoy it.
Oh. Okay, well then keep up the excellent work.
Thank you.
All right, and thank you too again, Mr. Dorakak.
Thank you, sir.
All right.